Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
So constructive institutionalism is when leaders sit down and act like everything's going to work out, even though by the numbers, there's no reason to think that it will work out.
And they make you feel good.
And so that
wow, he was so inspiring. Yeah, we're not doing shit. But yeah. I feel good.
And every organization's interests are toward constructive institutionalism because, you know, it'll just make you feel better. And government is so guilty of this all the time. I said to a group of business leaders the other day, I was like, look, you've all been named to these government honorary advisory boards and whatnot. And we know you do not do shit. You get together, you take a photo op. It looks like everyone's on board and you go home and you do nothing. Mm-hmm. So that's the nature of the problem that I defined as constructive institutionalism in my book. And I got to say, that chapter, I wrote that in like the middle of the night where I was like having dark
just
thoughts.
Yeah.
And then I woke up the next morning being like, I'm going to read what I wrote and see if it's like, you know, acceptable. And it ended up being one of my favorite.
It's your best chapter. I would argue that's a chapter that why, definitely for me and probably you too, why you ran for president, why I joined you, why it just clicked.
Hey everyone, welcome back. Me and Zach are in the studio to talk the Trump SPAC, constructive institutionalism. What the heck is that? Why so many of us don't know where to turn to for information or news anymore. But let's get started with the news that was all over the internet and mainstream news sources. Trump has a special purpose acquisition company.
It's a bit of a gimmick.
It's a bit of a gimmick. So for those of you who don't know what a SPAC is, check it out.
Okay.
A SPAC is you go to the public markets and say, hey, we're raising money to buy a private company to be named later sometime in the next 2 years to do whatever we sketch our plan out to be. Now, sometimes the plans aren't that, shall we say, robust. And in this case, though, this company was meant to start Truth Social Media, a whole new parallel social media network, or plural networks. So think a new Facebook, a new Twitter.
New Netflix.
A new Netflix. Wow, I didn't know that was
digital,
on there.
Yeah, it's social and then digital, like, streaming content.
Wow, no wonder they raised so much money.
It's the Trump Media and Technology Group, TMTG, has raised. They IPO'd at $9.96, $9.94, somewhere around there. And at one point, it was over $94 in terms of what it's trading. That's a lot of money that has raised. And it's a bit of a meme stock, too. So those of you who follow Wall Street Bets, which we've covered on this show, you may have gotten in on this. And we will not say this is a good investment or not. I'm going to plead the fifth.
No investment advice here on the Forward Podcast. So this is a fascinating play. Mm-hmm. I think most of us are immediately dubious because Trump has a storied track record of throwing his name on businesses that may be more sizzled than steak, shall we say.
And nice.
There's a Trump steak
nicely
joke
done
in there. So I saw this and thought to myself, who in the Trump universe could possibly create a Facebook rival or a Twitter rival or a Netflix rival? And the answer is nobody knows. You know, like, it's unclear whether they could muster the type of talent and personnel to get that done, because a lot of the tech talent, frankly, does not want to hang out with the Trump universe and throw their name on things. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is this real sense of, you know, polarization, shall we say. And on this side, I will say that I'm dubious. I'll throw that out there, whether they can pull this off. But there is something really interesting and powerful about this where you do have these quasi-monopolies that now are valued at, let's call it $1 trillion plus.
Right.
And so if someone credible comes along and makes a business case that we can create a challenger to the monopoly, investors can legitimately get excited and imagine it becoming very, very valuable.
If you're a venture investor or you're high risk, high reward type, this makes sense to, you know, because the upside is very, very high. I would say, so I read the deck. I read the pitch deck.
Nice
did some
work.
Homework for this episode,
who
folks.
Who knew that Zach worked on Wall Street?
So you I don't did. Have to. So here's what it says they're going to do. The TMTG, I'm going to quote here, aspires to create a media powerhouse to rival the liberal media consortium and fight back against the big, quote, big tech, close quote, companies of Silicon Valley who have used their unilateral power to silence opposing voices in America. And so, and if you look through this, there's a bunch of media headlines talking about how Facebook, Twitter, Amazon, Wikipedia, Apple, and Stripe have all banned Donald Trump or conservative personalities. They did have an interesting point where Twitter banned Donald Trump, but allowed the spokesperson from the Taliban to keep their account. So I get some of the frustration, if you will, on that side. They talked about every major media outlet in the United States. So they started with newspapers and then radio and cable TV and now social media eventually splits on ideological lines. And they had a bunch of examples of this. And this is the point that they're making is that they're going to lead the newest split. Here's my one comment I will say. It did look like a lot of decks I had made back on...
Did you make this deck, Zach?
I did not make this deck. But my point was that I could have made this deck. Was that it was one of those decks that like tells a fun story, but there's no meat. And so any real investor would be like, that sounds great. Show me your numbers. Or in this case, they're just essentially betting on the Trump name.
The thing I would think would be like, show me the team. Show me like who the heck is actually going to build this thing.
Correct. So a couple fun things. So slide 9 is just a graph of the U.S. population
growing.
Saying that because the population is bigger, they will be ripe for further segmentation. That was hilarious.
I got to say that makes a pretty good business case for starting anything under the sun. You know,
it's like there's more people. You can do more business.
Yang's Umbrella Co. Here's a slide. More people. Hence, more need for umbrellas.
One was just showing how many social media followers Trump has. 146.6 million across Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Slide 11 is actually helpful to size the digital media market, whether it's Netflix or Twitter or various.
Listen to you, Zach. Sounds like you want to invest in this thing.
I like the macro play. Realistically, like there's a.
So this is the first thing that came to mind for me, and this might be a sign of how my brain works. It's not a great comparison at all, but it reminded me of people making the case for starting a rival professional wrestling outfit because WWE had a quasi-monopoly and it was worth $1 billion. And it was like, well, you can't have a monopoly.
Yeah.
And then they try and start a new wrestling league. The problem is that a lot of the dynamics in that industry kind of steer everyone towards the same place because the dominant player ends up absorbing a bunch of the talent.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, this is going to be fascinating. I think that there's been a real miss in terms of the public discussion of what we should be concerned about where social media companies are concerned.
Right. We're going to talk about that.
Yeah. So if conservatives were like, hey, censorship, it's like, if you look at like the top, you know, 10, 20, 100 accounts on Facebook, a lot of them are conservative. Conservative content does really well in these social media networks.
Right.
And so it doesn't seem like there's any kind of systematic stamping out of news sources from particular sides or whatnot. Actually, if anything, you know, there's a stop hate on Facebook campaign, which made the opposite argument where it said that Facebook was too easy on various conservative outlets. So I'm not sure that is the issue, though I know that a lot of conservatives make that case. I think the more prevalent issues are that the social media networks are just really bad for our mental health and it's just oppressing the heck out of people. It's most clear with younger people, but it's true of everyone. You know, even Evelyn just the other day was, you know, off social media for a little while and then went back on social media for a little bit to promote something and then came on. It's like, man, like that was not exactly... You know, like it didn't really boost our spirits for the day. Let's put it that way.
So your point that like conservative content does well and has no problem getting a microphone, I think generally is true. The bigger challenge, and I think we'll talk about this more in this episode, is like narrative stuff. So
I believe that there are very real biases to be reckoned with. But I was making the case that if there are a couple things I'm most deeply concerned about where social media networks are concerned,
it's less this, it's more mental.
Number one is the erosion and disintegration of our mental health. Number two would be the complete fragmentation of information, where at this point truth is whatever the heck my filter bubble says it is. So they're like 24 different truths.
Yep.
So we can't have a shared conversation. Right. It's the fact that our democracy is being subverted, where you have foreign actors who are just ginning us up against each other and using these tools to kind of expose this underbelly we have, where we're not very together as a society, shall we say.
Right.
And so the splintering can have really negative, even disastrous effects. So those are some of the things that come to mind for me first. And that there are a handful of voices that have run afoul of the standards of the social media companies strikes me as an issue, to be sure. But when I talk to the folks at the social media companies about that issue, they look and say, look, we don't even want to be making these decisions.
Yeah.
It's just right now they're being forced into making these decisions because they've become the de facto public square and our government's nowhere to be found. Our government's essentially like, do what you want. Regulate yourselves. And then, we're going to yell at you for whatever decision you make. And then the tech companies are like, well, do you want to make this decision? And then the government's like, oh, we could never make that decision, you know? And so you're like, well, you know,
we get hurt. Yeah.
It's kind of a lose-lose because wherever they draw the line, someone's going to get mad.
Right.
So that's, you know, that back to the Trump SPAC. It's a fascinating business case.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these social media networks genuinely do hew towards winner take all, where frankly, if there's like a place I go, like I'm on Twitter a lot, everyone knows that. You know, one of the benefits is that everyone else is on Twitter. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so like if someone said, hey, Andrew, here's a new social media network, and I'd go there
and
I find out that, you know, 80% of the people that I know of are not there, then I'd be like, well, this is kind of not very awesome. It's very hard to overcome that network effect as a new player. You would generally, if you were a company trying to do this, you would seed it with awesome people.
Yes.
You'd be like, come here, and then all of
pay
these,
you whatever.
Yeah, that's right. And that is one of the things you're seeing in this space, is that they are running around trying to pay certain influencers to seed some of these social media networks. And even then, it's a real uphill battle. It's a real slog.
So a couple things from this deck, and then we'll shift gears. So in this deck, they talked, and this is the Trump Media and Technology Group's survey. But one of the poll they showed was that a third of the country would use a Trump social media platform, one third. So, and that's 54% of Republicans, 24% independents, and even 12% of Democrats. I'd argue if you're using the Trump social media platform, you're probably not really a team Democrat, I guess.
Or maybe they're just to mess around. I don't know.
Yeah, who knows? So I would say, like, from a macro standpoint, yeah, this is actually interesting. The bigger one to me is less about, to your point on social media, like, that's always hard. And if it's just a right-wing bubble, then...
Are you thinking of the content? You thinking a new movie studio?
Yeah,
TV
I think
that
the TMTG Plus streaming content is interesting. In the sense that, like, if you are not a liberal and you watch the Oscars, you're not loving it, right? You are feeling, and there's certain types of content that have become, you're feeling either preached to or feel like it's politicized. And if you're super against it, you're hating it. And if you're moderate, you're seeing it, right? So there is a market for, I think, either more neutral or more conservative leaning, like general content, but it'll come down to execution.
What this makes me think of is Christian content.
It
comes out, and sometimes you have these hit movies and albums and whatnot that aren't considered, I suppose, mainstream, even though some of them have vast audiences. That's what occurred to me.
Good point.
Though I'm not sure if this Trump world content is going to mirror Christian content.
It is very, I was raised Christian and I am a Christian, and it is very difficult for me to see anything Christ-like in what Donald Trump does.
Yeah,
and that drives me absolutely bonkers that the evangelical right is like, Donald Trump's our guy. Are you kidding me? Like, come on. Anyway, that's not the point. We're not here to preach at you, but I agree. And I think if you're a parent and you're watching the Lil Nas video of, like, you know, him literally as the devil, doing various things. I don't think there's a lot of parents like, I don't want that for my child, right? For better or for worse, and that's your opinion. But there is a market for it, I think.
There's certainly, it's going to be fascinating to see. Another thing this makes me think of is that I think they made a movie with Gina Carano as soon as Disney canceled her.
That's right.
Yeah, so that they'll take some canceled figures. Yeah. So wait, let's make a list just for fun. So the new programming would star Kevin Spacey, Gina Carano.
Kevin Spacey's actually a pedophile, which I don't like.
I'm just throwing it out there. It's like,
which is a bummer because I loved Kevin Spacey.
Who would be like the canceled greatest?
Gal Gadot got kind of hammered.
Gal Gadot is still very mainstream.
She's still doing things up.
Gal's gonna be
Roseanne.
Roseanne would be there.
Roseanne. Terry Crews.
Terry Crews got canceled.
Oh yeah, he's a Republican. I think Terry Crews got canceled.
Terry Crews would be there. Kelsey Grammer's there.
Chappelle would be there, I guess.
Chappelle would not be there. You gotta be fucking kidding me. There'll be nowhere near this.
You're right. That's the thing. Like a lot of these folks, like you have actual assholes who deserve to be canceled and they would get mopped up here. And then you have people who are not assholes who have been quote unquote canceled or like gotten in hot water and they wouldn't want to be associated with
I mean, essentially, anyone who can just hop on to mainstream media offerings will stay there.
Yeah.
The people that can't get that kind of booking will come here. So it was sort of fun for me to think about who those figures are.
Yeah. Where they'll make their money is probably the content. Like if they can raise enough money, which it looks like they are, to produce shows and the shows are good, people watch them. Not everyone, but they don't have to. Like Donald Trump has a big enough audience, we'd get enough people to persuade some advertisers. And look, there's a reason OAN exists. There's a reason Newsmax exists. There are advertisers and a lot of people that watch that stuff. So if you're just pure business objective, I think, I don't think this is going away. The point I have was earlier is like, it's going to be an execution thing. And I don't think that Donald has proven great execution on a lot of businesses that he is running. It depends. He slaps his name on hotels.
I think that you can make an ideological cable news offering and make it a more viable business more easily than you could trying to produce genuine scripted content. Mm. Because if you think about conservative talk radio, very low cost, you can get an audience. Even some of these upstart new cable news offerings, pretty low cost. You get a studio, as long as you get like the distribution channel, then you're off to the races. But if you have scripted content, I mean, that stuff gets expensive. It's very hard to do well.
High risk.
People have very high standards for it. It's very high risk. And so if you look at even major Hollywood movies or TV shows or whatnot, we're in a funny time because now who knows what's profitable, but a lot of them have a hard time turning a profit and they have, let's say, 80% of the sandbox to play in or something like
good
that.
Point.
So if you start out with 15% of the sandbox and say, hey, make some movies, make some TV shows, like I think you're fucked personally, as you can tell. So that's Andrew's take on it.
My take would be, I like the concept of talking to a broader part of the country. I don't like the concept of in talking to them, you're making Donald Trump more rich.
Well, I think that you can, again, you can build on those existing business models. Like could they start a fledgling cable channel? I'd believe it.
Yeah.
Could they start, social media is tough because on that one, that stuff is advertising driven. So they're having a smaller sandbox will, again, really hurt you. As you can tell, I'm dubious about their ability to get into some of these traditional businesses successfully.
One downside, and probably should talk about this, is that let's say he wins presidency in 2024, which is something we've talked about, this becomes like an authoritarian mouthpiece of bullshit, which feels a little scary.
That would be very bizarre, where the president's like, I only talk
on
to channel Trump.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then everyone would be like, on channel Trump today, Trump said this, and then he's making money off it. One thing that does irk me is that, we do things. I mean, I've run campaigns, I've started organizations and whatnot, and we always have these like massive compliance teams being like, got to do this right, you got to do that right. And then when it comes to Trump and the gang, they're like, there are no rules at all. And everyone's like, he's breaking the rules. And then they're like,
No one's enforcing them. They're not really rules then.
Yeah, which does bring us to, I think, one of the things that has fed Trump this entire time. There's something I talk about in my book And I had to come up with a name for it. So the
I love this name, although I forget it a lot.
So the name of this idea is constructive institutionalism, which I actually made purposefully benign because I wanted someone to be able to use it with someone else without seeming like they're insulting you.
Ooh, yeah. And also the people that are guilty of constructive institutionalism would totally use the phrase constructive institutionalism.
That's what I was going for. So what the heck am I talking about? And I think that this is something that really feeds the rise of Trump and mm-hmm. people that think that all the media are bullshit and that all these institutions are bullshit. And so that this was something I had to kind of dig deep on. And it was born in part of a comment from Eric Weinstein a little while ago where he said that this economy is making liars of us all. And then you asked him, well, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, you have these institutions that pretend that they're going to give the academics tenure, that they're going to make the new lawyers partners eventually. And then later they have to come back and be like, yeah, turns out those positions don't exist.
JK.
Yeah. And now you're in, this permanent purgatory as an adjunct, or you're a lawyer forever who will never make partner. And so you have all of these assumptions around growth that if they don't hold true, then you're having to lie to a lot of people in various ways. And I thought that he was right. And I realized that it's happening around us all the time. And it also built into some of my own experiences where I would do countless interviews or sit on a panel. And then I get asked a question that kind of presupposes that it's going to work out. So here's one that you all will have heard a million times. How are we going to ensure that growth is equitable and includes people of different backgrounds? And then I process that. And then the way I answer on a panel is like, well, we have to really, work hard to find the people that right now are being left behind and make sure they have access to this. And if you can see, like, the real answer is, we will not. If someone there says, like, how are we going to retrain millions of Americans for the jobs of the future? The answer is we will not. How are we going to overcome polarization? Almost certainly will not. How are we going to, all of these big problems, but the way it's framed to you, it's kind of a dick move.
Solvable problem. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, one, it's presented to you as a solvable problem, and then you virtue signal by saying, like, well, we got to dig deep and make sure that people that aren't getting to the table right now get there. And then we all go home, and no one actually is going to go and try and find the person who's not at the table and bring them to the table. So I've been a part of these gatherings all of the time, and we do just kind of bullshit each other. The kabuki or the pantomime becomes the deliverable, where it's like, as long as I showed up to the session and said the right things and made the right value statements, then everyone's like, okay, we're working on it. And then everyone goes home and thinks about, and I've obviously been a part of this. So, to the extent that there's like any responsibility or complicity or whatnot, I mean, certainly I'd raise my hand and say, yeah, like I've done this shit countless times.
This was UBS. So I would bring, we have billionaires in the room. I would invite you and a bunch of other social entrepreneurs.
Thanks for the invite.
To come on the panel. And the goal is to raise money, make connections to help your org because you're doing great work. And the panel goes like this. Andrew, you've done something incredible. Tell me about how your program works. And you just kind of do the pitch of why VFA is awesome. Tell a couple fun stories, charm the crowd. But at no point would it be appropriate for me to be like, yeah, your program's not really working. What are the actual core problems with it? And why can't we fix it, at a fundamental level? I would never ask that because, one, you're doing me a favor and the organization a favor by coming. And two, then we all kind of look bad. And so there's like, your point is just this like nonsense, not talking about the elephant in the room, which is philanthropy's broken. The people in the room that can do something about it either don't know or don't care or can do nothing. That's probably one of the three.
Or the scale is wrong. And that's one of the things that drove me is that if you look at the largest nonprofit in the country, I think its entire budget is in the hundreds of millions, something along those lines.
Yeah, if you're excluding like big hospitals, I guess.
Yeah, I'd have to look at that. I mean, I guess if you had hospitals, you'd probably find somewhere with like a
universities
billion
dollars. Maybe.
Oh, universities, don't get me started. I mean, there'd be like 20 universities with billion-dollar endowments for sure. But if you look at annual budgets of operating nonprofits, I think the highest budgets are in the, let's say, hundreds of millions. And then if you look at the scale of the economy, it's $22 trillion. And so
peanuts.
So if you have, and so, an I ran an organization that was in the like the low millions, but like our ability to effectuate real change at the right scale would be close to zero.
Yeah.
And so.
And you were doing great work. Like, as someone who had to find the people doing good work, I mean, I can count on two hands maybe of like really innovative new work. That's not a knock on people who are doing, you know, wonderful saint-like work, but in terms of new innovative pushing the envelope, there weren't a lot of people doing it. Even you were like, yeah, scales off.
Well, and so people at home, Zach also started a nonprofit. Yep. It's extraordinarily wholesome called Suit Up.
Suit Up, volunteer Suit Up. I'll plug it. If you guys are looking for a better volunteer day, we do a really good job. And we'll be $1 million organization by the end of the year, which is crazy, dude. Started that with like $200.
So what Suit Up does is it pairs struggling school kids with professional mentorship opportunities where they get presentations from people who are in professional environments to try and get their heads up to the fact that there are real opportunities out there if they stay in school and try and do good work.
And you structure it like there, instead of your park cleanup or soup kitchen, you do a one-day volunteer day where like it's a company like signs up for this and pays for it, and then the kids get real world, you know, mentorship and access, and the company gets a better way to volunteer. However, same problem, like scale, both, there's either too many students. When we were doing them in person, we couldn't, you know, too many schools to work with. And two, companies have like this much budget, like a small sliver of their budget is meant for employee engagement, which is not a ton of money. It's usually 10% of their overall philanthropic budget. And their philanthropic budget, of course, is also small. So you're not talking about a large
piece. Zach and I have each started, it sounds like, what will either be soon or are $1 million nonprofits, multi-million nonprofits. And both of us realized that we needed to go bigger to try and solve the fundamental problems that are getting hairier and more far-reaching and more serious all the time. So constructive institutionalism is when leaders sit down and act like everything's going to work out, even though by the numbers, there's no reason to think that it will work out.
And they make you feel good.
And they make you feel good. And so that
wow, he was so inspiring. Yeah, we're not doing shit, but yeah. I feel good.
And every organization's interests are toward constructive institutionalism because, you know, it'll just make you feel better. And government is so guilty of this all the time. I said to a group of business leaders the other day, I was like, look, you've all been named to these government honorary advisory boards and whatnot. And we know you do not do shit. You get together, you take a photo op, it looks like everyone's on board, and you go home and you do nothing. Mm-hmm. And really savvy business leaders, you know, sometimes do it just so that it seems. And you get to hang out with other business leaders. So
there's networking and selfish gain. And
But in terms of actually, like, you know, moving shit, it's like very, very seldom do these things actually have real impact or deliverables. Even some of like the major commitments, when you go to some of these conferences, they'll say, it's like, look, just commit the thing you were going to do anyway. Mm. And there's very little in the way of follow-up.
None.
Right? Like, none. It's almost never like, hey, like, did he do the thing he was going to do the thing? I think people sense this. So there's a lot of bullshit going on, really. And then so when someone runs around, let's call him Donald Trump, and calls bullshit, there are a lot of people that are like, oh, yeah, it is bullshit. Like, why is college going up in price every fucking year? Like, why is my healthcare going up in cost every year? And it's like, you know, like they're real freaking problems. And then if you get people from the institutions in there, like, no one's like, oh, yeah, like we're really shafting the hell out of people. We're doing it at scale, you know, so there's this real fervor around trying to change things, and it's getting channeled in very, very destructive and unconstructive ways, in part because the people who man or staff or run these institutions can't do anything about these deep problems because none of their incentives are in standing up and saying, yeah, you know, that this is actually fundamental. It's more like, oh, we're working on this thing. Check it out. We've got this initiative. And, you know, we're spending whatever, like half of 1% of our company's budget on it. And we're going to have an event around it. And then we'll get some people to say nice things. So that's the nature of the problem that I defined as constructive institutionalism in my book. And I got to say, that chapter, I wrote that in like the middle of the night where I was like having dark
just
thoughts.
Yeah.
And then I woke up the next morning being like, I'm going to read what I wrote and see if it's like, you know, acceptable. And it ended up being one of my favorite.
It's your best chapter. I would argue that's a chapter that why, definitely for me and probably you too, why you ran for president, why I joined you, why I just clicked. when I started Suit Up, I was part-time at UBS, but I was full-time at UBS, so I was part-time running this organization. And the number one thing people said to me was, and it was really humbling at first, like, oh, that's so impressive. Like, how do you find the time to do that? And my gut reaction to that was like, what the fuck are you talking about? These kids are screwed. Like, they have nothing. Like, why are we doing nothing? Like, stop brunching on the weekends and maybe help out a little bit. And it was, and that's literally how I found time. Was like,
you skipped the
didn't
brunch.
Drink as much on Saturday at 11 a.m. And look, that is fun. I do like a good brunch. Who doesn't? But that was what was driving me nuts. And we have a very, it's not as simple as like the 1% elitists. It's bigger than that. It's like our corporate culture where people are working in the
we're all market mainstream. Actors.
Right.
We're all market actors.
And we talk about this stuff. We feel good. We go to the gala, we pay our thing, we go to the open bar, but we just don't give a shit.
Or what I called it was light commitment benevolence. Like, I'll do enough so that I can feel good, but I'm not really
I'm better
going
than
to,
the average.
But I'm not going to like make a meaningful sacrifice. I'm not going to like bet the rent. You know what I mean? Like, I'll do something where I can show up to your thing and have a couple of drinks.
Let me ask you this. So I was just on Adam Carolla's podcast called Take a Knee. Which Andrew's going on soon. He's going on the main one. I got like the JV one. I think it's behind the paywall, but it was fun. Adam's like an interesting character, but a good guy. He was nice to me, and I was grateful to be on there. But one thing he said in this was that, I'm curious your thoughts. He said, so I was talking about my mom was a teacher and my dad went into business as an engineer, and he said, don't overhype the saint move. Because those who do go into business and create thousands of jobs and pay millions in taxes or whatever, that sort of thing, there is a lot of good, arguably a lot more good done by contributing to the economy at that scale. And I heard him say that, and I thought, like, on one hand, there's a lot of truth to that. Like, building things does add a ton of value. But I didn't think it was fundamentally true. And I feel like you're smarter than me to understand why I was kind of like, on that. Like, thoughts on that pushback on... instead of maybe building the schools, it's better to create a whole bunch of jobs and that rising tide will lift all boats.
Wow. Because I literally wrote a book called Smart People Should Build Things, trying to lionize folks who actually go out and do like create jobs.
Because he was like, that person who creates jobs is vilified more today. I don't know, somewhat.
He's not wrong about that. I mean, you know, like we certainly are down on business people.
It's very hard to start stuff.
In a way. Yeah. I mean, I admire people who start a business at any level.
Agreed.
You know, lemonade stand,
it's hard,
diner,
it's freaking
whatever
hard.
It is, it's super hard. I don't think there's anything wrong with trying to hold up folks who work in jobs that serve the public good. The jobs that come to mind for me are like teachers or firefighters.
Agreed.
You know, or nurses or people that you know that you're probably a caring individual if you're there ministering to folks or teaching our kids or whatnot.
And we should pay him. It should be a living, healthy wage.
We should be paying a lot of these.
They shouldn't
folks
be worried
more.
Too much about money, right?
Yeah, I admit I have a feeling, and this is one of the themes of my campaign. Is like, you know, do you want me to say nice shit about you, or do you want me to give you money? And everyone would be like, give me the money,
and please. Just, like, yeah, I'd rather be an asshole, but give me money. Right?
Yeah,
agreed.
Yeah,
because everybody's kind of an asshole at some point, right?
And that is one of the diseases, is like we just get pressured into the virtue signal of being like, oh, you know, like essential, like thank you. It's like the workers don't care what the fuck you call them if you just give them some more money. And like that would be preferable than like having us all be like, you're essential or, you know, thank you. It's like, you know, I can thank you by being willing to pay more so that you can bring some more home to your family.
You've talked about this before, is like when you're an employer, when you have an employee, you want to take care of them. You can do a couple of things. You can tell them good job. You can promote them, or you can pay them more money. And those are like your three options. I think if I'm doing it right.
Oh,
and
forgot,
almost always they want more
number
money.
One really is do nothing.
Oh, do nothing.
but the one that will, like the other things can work temporarily, but the only thing that works long term is more money.
All right, that's a good segue, Andrew.
Wait. I'm going to put the forward party hat on because we're going to put the thinking cap on, and we're going to talk about the thing that so many people talk about, which is what is going on with our news media and why do people feel like they have no idea where to go to get information they can trust?
Oh, that's a good segue because both the Trump's media company and constructive institutionalism all kind of play into all of the problems with our media. First, though, plug for the Forward merch. You're looking pretty good, man. That hat's actually pretty cool.
Well, thank you. I feel very heroic and patriotic.
There it is.
It's like heroic. A good feeling, you know what I mean?
You look kind of heroic. I like it.
Oh, thank you. A little bit of a Captain America vibe going.
There you go. All right. I did watch flying back from LA, I watched The Last Avengers again. And I always cry at the end because Robert Downey Jr. and Spider-Man, Iron Man, Spider-Man always gets me. That's not the point. What the hell's wrong with the media? We both made lists. Let's you go first, because we know anyone listening to this knows they're going to be smarter than whatever the hell I come up with.
Well, the major problem with the news media right now is the commercial incentives, where if you try and present something in an even-handed, objective way, it's less enticing and people reward you less by coming to you. And so the more kind of red meat you throw someone's way, the more excited they get. If you push the envelope a bit, if you're a little more sensationalist, if you're a bit more ideological. There was an MSNBC producer, Ariana Bakari, who said that if they had a peaceful protest and a protest with some flames or violence, they would just show the flames and violence over and over again.
Obviously.
And then they would cut away from anything peaceful because they were like, well, this is some boring programming. Mm-hmm. So you can see that incentive playing out in pretty much every media organization you can name.
Car crash, right?
Yeah, and when you think about the news media, in my opinion right now, you think about cable news because they're so dominant. Mm-hmm. And when I was running for president, they felt like the only game in town very, very often, because if you go on a news program of another network, let's call it ABC or whatnot, you're not going to go back on that network for weeks, maybe mm-hmm. months, because mm-hmm. they can't just keep talking to you. Mm-hmm. But cable news, you could go on, you know, different shows 5-6 times in a given week.
Yep.
And so it feels like they're the only game in town. And they are definitely very ideological in bent. Certainly Fox and MSNBC, you can just look at the numbers and see. And that's, I think, problem number one, is just that you get rewarded for being a little bit more aggressive, sensationalist, and ideological. And if that's the way your organization gets rewarded, that's where you're going to go.
And it kind of tracks to human nature now. Like, we like the excitement piece. Or if you're going to take time out of your day to read something, it's more instinctive that you'll find the
We've
thing.
We've all
that,
definitely like succumbed object. To it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, and so I'm going to take the next ingredient, which is social media. Mm-hmm. And studies have shown that negative sentiment and falsehood spread 6 times more quickly and powerfully on social media than truth.
Yeah.
So if you're an organization that, again, pushes the envelope, you're more likely to get clicks and traffic. And any content producer will tell you, I produced content. You know what you do after you produce content? Wait to see how many people look at it. You know, you produce a video, it's like, oh, how many people watch that video? Mm-hmm. How many people are going to listen to this podcast? Mm-hmm. And so over time, you start thinking, oh, if I get a little bit zanier, like a little bit more
if
aggressive.
I title it this way. You're just pandering to the YouTube algorithm or whatever.
A matter of fact, Zach, we should trash someone right now just to get some numbers.
Oh, yeah. Who do you want to trash?
That fucking guy.
Tom Brady, screw you.
Oh, wow. We can both pile on Tom Brady. That's good stuff. Good stuff. Good choice.
Like
good choice.
Touchdown passes on Sunday.
My list goes number one, commercial incentives, and then number two, social media incentives that also are commercial but are a little bit more personal and human.
Mm-hmm. I had that it's factual but not accurate. That always bothered me. So we talk about this when people say numerous sources or many people had said, but it's also this one that I love, where a fringe outlet or small young quote unquote journalist writes a clickbait piece for, let's call it Business Insider or The Verge or one of these like smaller outlets. And then Washington Post, New York Times, or cable news can be accusations have been made of blank, right? So not like they're not saying that the story's true, but it is true that an accusation was made, even if that accusation was fundamentally false. And I don't think people realize the layers of like how far away, it's almost like telephone, like how far away you get from the truth.
Media reporting on other media is certainly on this list of major problems, because there's a desire not to get scooped. And so if someone else reports something, then you're like, oh, we going to pile on this thing? And the answer often now tends to be yes. Even if, as you're describing, Zach, you're like, well, all I'm going to do is represent to you this reporting that may or may not be true.
Right.
But I'm just going to present it to you, and you can't attack me because, you know, it happened. You know, the other article happened. Even though we have no idea whether it's bullshit or not, and we have had no contact with any primary source, and we have nothing to add.
Yeah.
But we're just going to report on the reporting. There's like a lot of this meta stuff, and it feeds into this news cycle of the day feeding frenzy that something kind of flimsy can get put out there, particularly if, again, it's kind of negative and sensationalist. Yeah. And everyone will be like, oh, well, we can't just ignore it. Like, right. We have to let our readers know that this is happening.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you get my favorite from the reporters is, I'm going live with the story, whether you like it or not. And I'm like, well, I have 10 people on record that'll say the exact opposite, who are better, closer to the source, or X, Y, Z. Like, I'm going live with the story regardless. Do you have a comment? Can my comment be, I have 10 people close to the source that'll say the exact opposite? No, I'm not including that quote. Oh, then I don't know what to tell you. Like, that is like, those are very real conversations I've had multiple times. Now we get, you know, the context there is you're getting shivved for God knows what, for having built things, I guess, in your past. There is a journalistic code, like it exists, where they don't reveal their sources and they do fact check, but the fact check can be someone else said something. Another media outlet quoted this, so that's enough of a source for me. So that is one of my biggest concept of fact issues I have with the media.
Well, so what you just suggested, Zach, is a dynamic that probably should be on the list. So journalists have sources and relationships. And one of the things that political operatives do in particular is just try and feed a story to a friendly journalist. And mm-hmm. the journalist can either take it or not take it.
Right.
And so this happened certainly in the mayoral campaign all the time, where if you had five other candidates, like their entire day was spent trying to source negative stories about about other candidates. In that case, it was often me because I was the most conspicuous candidate at that time. So if you're a journalist, you're like, huh, okay, you're trying to have me print something. Is it true? Well, yeah, I can defend it journalistically.
I can defend it. It's defensible, like, not truth.
Yeah. Am I going to preserve my relationship with you by helping you out with this story and thus maybe get something from you later that will help me do my job? Yes. Mm-hmm. So defensible kind of helps me. Maybe I've known you for a while. Yeah, let's do it. And then that ends up producing things that objectively you're like, wait, why is that news? Or why is that newsworthy? Or like, doesn't that seem incomplete?
Right.
And that's a very real thing. That's one reason why you hire people whose job it is to have relationships with reporters so they can work them.
Okay, if you're a candidate, you're running a campaign, which by definition is a temporary organization, right? So it doesn't exist after the election or after a couple elections, depending on what you do, right? So therefore, these entire infrastructures are just being created and dying, right? And so what is the political institution that exists? It's the media, right? And then it's consultants who become basically experts in various aspects of politics. So you'll have a pollster that's an expert in polling, and you'll have a press consultant who has a bunch of relationships with a lot of these reporters, and you'll have a TV ads person, you'll have a digital media firm and an email expert, and all these folks, and they plug into candidates as they pop up, and the candidates hire them, these sort of things, and they have professional relationships with the media. So they are friends. But the thing that cuts the other way is that those reporters are not friends with the campaign. Like, they're never your friend. They'll shiv you at any point. If they ever pretend to be your friend, they are not. So it cuts the wrong way, where you may be saying that's not true, but your XYZ consultant and your team may be like, well, it may not be true, but we can't bash this reporter because I need them down the road, or I need them for my other clients, or God knows what. And so you end up in this very precarious or confusing situation, I think, where the incentives for you as a candidate and the incentives for your consultants or experts or institutional, you know, political.
Well, they're repeat players. They got to think about the next client, the next job. I made the same comparison in the political side with political consultants. It's like they're NFL coaches who would rather lose professionally than have anything high variance occur.
Right.
So that's why it seems like everyone's the same.
Yes. Yeah. You'd rather like go, 4-12 or whatever, 4-13, I guess, not a 17 game, then shoot for the win, but flame out, right? Because no consultant wants to be like, oh, you worked on that campaign? That was a disaster.
They'd
right?
much rather a boring much loss.
Be like, oh, yeah, you worked on.
And that's related to the media stuff, you're right. Because right. like the media and the handlers and the consultants all have a long-term relationship. Though I will say that what you're describing is an issue with specifically political media, but that's cool because a lot of people listening to this will be like, oh, you know.
Yeah, that's a political thing. So much in business media at all. You actually want to be friends with the CEOs and that sort of startup founders if you're a business reporter, right?
Yeah, I enjoy business journalists for this reason. Business journalists have kind of, you know, more positive incentives. One other issue I think is wrong with our news today is just there's too much freaking time. You know what I mean? Like when I was growing up, you had the evening news. It's like 30 minutes. You had local news, 30 minutes. Now you have to fill, what, I guess 24 hours of programming?
And weekends.
And so if you gave me 24 hours to talk about the news in a given day, I would make no sense by hour number 5. You know what I mean? Which is one reason, again, why you have like reporting on reporting and you have like like the dynamics you do, because mm-hmm. you just have so much time to fill. As a product of the medium, you have to have these punchy 5 or 6 minute segments with like visuals and people coming in and out. I mean, everyone knows, I think, I was a contributor to CNN for a while. And, like, I was, like, a positive ingredient to add to the mix. It's like if you had a show, you would just be like, hey, let's get Yang on. And he can, like, talk intelligently about what's going on in Capitol Hill and policy for, like, 6 minutes. You know, I did my best to do that and, you know, like, add value and say things that I thought were, were going to be a positive contribution. But you just have so much time to fill that you wind up, I think, having to make certain types of decisions because you have to keep it somewhat interesting. You have to talk about things like they're important, you know, that are happening on a daily basis. One of the big things that I was trying to make the case for on my presidential campaign, which I think this case really needs to be made, is that you have all these deep-seated problems where we're, you know, 28th in the world in infant mortality or clean drinking water or things. But that there's nothing new. It's like there's no like news peg to that where it's like, yeah, we still suck.
We suck.
You know, suck again. You know, it's like so they're like the news pegs are all like stock market's up or like this person like is an asshole. And then like right. And then so we're just running. I feel like we're just getting distracted and like just getting like these shiny objects like shown to us on any given day while like the earth is turning into quicksand. And then more and more people are getting sucked into the quicksand and you're seeing different like cries for help. And the news media is just like, what's wrong with you? Like, well, why are you not like, you know, like, why do you not like what we're saying? And so that would be problem number, I don't know where we are on the list now, maybe 4, is that there's just like too much time for the news. You could throw in number 5, that there is a visual medium and a format. There is part of me that frankly is somewhat flattered that I was considered TV worthy, I guess. You know, there are a lot of people out there that are awesome that probably aren't great for like, you know, like frankly, yeah. like a commercial news medium.
I got the face for radio or whatever.
Yeah, you know what I mean? And like, and so there's like something so skewed about the medium. And then my problem number 6, which is tied to some of these things, is there's this sort of imperious, authoritative, condescending view that the media naturally takes, which I've summarized as get a load of this guy or get a load of this person. And so there is this continuous, the word that came to mind for me is like shaming, but there's like there's just a lot of shaming going on. And so if you're an average person looking up at this, you're like over time, you just begin to be like, hey, you know, maybe I'm more like the person you're shaming than I am you, like whoever you are behind the camera. And this reminds me of Sarah Palin back in 08 was like the media elite and the media establishment and the rest of it. And I heard it at the time and, you know, frankly, I thought Sarah Palin was, you know, not very worth heeding, shall we say. But there is like a very real tone and approach and condescension. Mm. And what's interesting, you and I haven't spoken about this before. Maybe we have a little bit. So another theme of my book is that running for office kind of like puts you through a particular kind of crucible.
Yeah.
And it challenges your perspective and mental health in a particular way. You know, yes, what really, really challenges your perspective and mental health? Being on live television 5 days a week for hours on end. Like, that stuff can really mess with your head.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know some of these people, obviously, some of them are just as sane as the day is long. Some of them are just, you know, like Anderson Cooper is just a really sane dude.
Yeah.
He can be on TV like over and over.
I like
again.
Dana Bash a lot.
Some of the people are just really very, very sane and it doesn't get to them. But other people, you can tell it's messed with them. And a lot of them too, like you get in that chair, they, you know, frankly throw makeup on you, like a lot of the people too. Like you know, you kind of have to be sort of like fixed in time, like you're in.
You have to be all perky. You have to be a certain level of perky to be on camera.
And just,
you know?
And just going back on it over and over again, it does take something out of you. It takes a certain sort of exertion and it messes with you.
Mm-hmm.
And that there is a distortion that occurs with the news media that when you say, like, quote unquote, like the media elites, like there is something there, and it's not necessarily anyone's fault, you know, because, you know, again, I know some of these people, but does that dynamic exist that where they'll right. be caring about things that the average person does not care about? They'll be making a big deal out of things that, like, you know, a lot of people don't care about? 100%, yeah.
It's become a commodity now, and with the advent of smartphones, frankly, and social media, in commodity in the sense that anybody can create news and content pretty easily.
Case in point.
Yes, this, you know, forward.
Andrew and Zach.
And what's your differentiator then? It's like we had at UBS, it was the two things that helped our UBS, like money management. Anyone can manage your money, right? But what kept UBS afloat was trust, whether it was FDIC insured or the scale or a lot of people use them. And then regulation, which can be a moat, like the government involvement can be a moat around keeping a business alive. And I think the connection between media and our, like mainstream media and our government is what keeps them powerful and trustworthy and thriving in some ways or thriving enough. So this is my example in, I know you don't fully agree, but my example is Catherine Garcia in the New York City mayor's race.
Sure.
So Catherine Garcia polling at, these are just facts, polling at essentially zero, low single digits, no social media following, no name ID, never been an elected official before. She's a city government operator, sanitation head, not a particularly compelling public speaker or debater. And that's not my opinion. There's like New York Times is pretty harsh on her and her debating skills and other outlets. There were no unique marketing tactics or anything out of the box or out of the ordinary from the Catherine Garcia campaign and had not raised a ton of money. There was nothing particularly exceptional about Catherine Garcia, except one thing. She was endorsed by the New York Times and she went from low single digits to the high 25, 30% contending with Eric Adams for the W, contending with you, contending with everybody, and almost won. And that's the only thing. So my point is there's still a power there where if New York Times says, like, you're the guy, you're the gal, and you could go from literally an uninspiring campaign, and we like her as a human, I believe, and you know her better than I do.
Yeah, I like Catherine.
But she went from literally like a non-factor in the race at some point with the blessing to a major contender. Do you think the media should have that play? I know their role is theoretically to help educate the populace on what's, who you should vote for. But I don't know, with today's information, I don't know if that's needed as much. What do you think there?
I personally appreciated that they decided to get behind Catherine as opposed to some of the other candidates.
That's fair.
But to your point, 69% of Democrats have a high trust in media.
Yeah.
Independents, it's 36%. Republicans, it's only 15%. You have this still establishment heating body of Democratic voters who want to hear from the news media who they should support, who's been blessed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the dynamic. The problem is right now it's essentially a one-sided asymmetrical dynamic where it's mainly true on the Democratic side.
Mm-hmm.
Republican side does not care.
I don't care, yeah.
And then there's like an increasing body of people in the middle, which I'm going to throw myself in this body, where we're starting to become increasingly concerned about what's going on in terms of the establishment and the news media's ability to present something that's objective as opposed to being politically motivated. I mean, that's where I think most Americans are at this point, is like, hey, like, who do I trust? Like, you know, is there a fix in for a particular group of candidates? And we certainly saw on the Democratic side, they tried to shiv Bernie at every turn in 16, and they really successfully sandbagged him. You saw a kind of a repeat of that in 2020 to some extent. You had different candidates having different types of treatment, myself included. And like, and Americans look at this and we're like, you know what? Like, I get the sense that there are some people trying to put their thumb on the scale. And then the Republican side, you know, it's like all heck is breaking loose. And you know, Trump kind of overrode a lot of what people imagined as institutional safeguards. And now the institutions have decided that Trump is the path until further notice. So the issues are asymmetrical. When you ask, like, does the news media have a rightful role in this? They are taking on this role 100%. They may or may not acknowledge it all the time, but they are 100% in the tank for one candidate or another, and then they're just going to push. I almost appreciate it more when they actually come out and say, like, hey, we're in the tank for this candidate.
I like that too, because they're for-profit companies, so, you know, just be honest.
But that there is stuff going on behind the scenes all the time that I now realize, where that, you know, you have very, very senior powers that be at these organizations saying, okay, here's who we're going to elevate, here's who we're going to ignore. You know, again, for us personally, Ariana Picari, the MSNBC producer, said that she was instructed not to interview a number of candidates, including me, in 2019. And she was like, no reason given, just here are some candidates, don't talk to them. So these things are going on in news, in these news media organizations. And it's one reason why people are starting to check out or mistrust.
We complained a lot on this podcast. I like to be a podcast of action. Thoughts on how to start solving for this is obviously a huge issue. I think, you know, I'll quickly say that I think, you know, we are the right answer. But like, content like our podcast is a step one, I think.
Well, so here's the main premise that I want to operate on that I think people are going to recognize. People have lost trust in institutions, but you know who we trust? Other people. Like, anyone listening to this has identified, I think, at least like a few independent voices or journalists were like, okay, like, they're straight shooters, I'll believe them. I might be one of them, and I thank you for it. If you decided that you trust me, thank you. I'll do everything I can to live up to that. Maybe you trust Crystal. Maybe you trust Sagar. Maybe you trust Sam Harris. Maybe you trust...
I love Peter Hamby. He's my favorite.
Peter Hamby. I like Peter too.
Oh, and Tim Alberto we had on. We should get him back on.
I love that. So you've identified some journalists that you like. Maybe
Brittany Johnson.
Maybe you even subscribe to their Substack.
Or Brittany Shepard, not Brittany Johnson. That's a friend. Sorry, Brittany Shepard.
Yeah, maybe you even subscribe to their Substack. So here's what is missing in American life, and what I actually am going to try and provide, not me individually, but, you know, like, I want to build this thing, is that we need to build a constellation of individuals that you trust that can deliver you news and information in a way that is comparable to the way it's happening from the traditional news media on the left or the right. It's like this independent provider of news that you can trust that will say very clearly, you know, if there's like a relationship or a bias or we get something wrong, it'd be human. You know what I mean? Like, people trust people. And so if we can get enough of those people together, and I want to be one of them, then we can try and solve this problem. And this can help build a solution to what's going wrong in our politics and our society. Is if people get some information that they believe in, that's objective, that doesn't succumb to some of these either market-based or institutional biases, then we have a chance to bring everyone back from the brink. Mm-hmm. I hope people are excited about this. So the Forward Party is the political movement, and then we're going to have a media movement too. This podcast is going to be part of it, and there's going to be much, much more to come. But these are the two projects I think are imperative for our country to make it through this hyper-polarized time. Mm-hmm. In a way, it's like a search for truth, provision of truth, and try to make a case that, look, there is some objective reality that's not subject to my politics or ideology.
Dare I say it, Donald Trump has inspired us again. We were thinking of a media come before he did his. But yeah, I mean, he inspired you to run for president, and now he's inspiring you to
I knew we needed this at some point when, like, actually a friend said to me, I have no idea where to go to get my news anymore.
That's common. A lot of people say
that. When I heard that, I thought to myself, he's right. We need to provide that.
Yeah.
So let's provide that. More to come. I hope you all are excited about that. Hopefully we can solve some of the problems in the news media that me and Zach just talked about.
Amen. Okay, this weekend's Halloween. I hope you guys enjoy your Halloween. Andrew, it's your wife's and your son's birthday. What's the plan, man? And what are you gonna be for Halloween? You're just gonna be Andrew Yang?
I could dress as myself. I actually saw a guy yesterday who said he's gonna dress up as me.
Did
and he? His wife's gonna dress up as Evelyn. It's very cute. Yeah, that's approved, by the way. Approved Halloween costume. It's pretty easy. You know what you need. All you need is a blue blazer and a oh my gosh, is that
like this?
Holy cow, why do I look so horrifying?
Horrifying. If you can't see the video, it's worth you watching on YouTube because I bought this on Amazon.
It's an Andrew Yang vinyl mask, and it looks like
this. It's a little racist, I think.
It's not just racist. It's actually just a little bit scary. Like, I look, you know,
whatever. You look like a horror movie, yeah.
Whatever, it's like
The Purge.
It's a horror movie version of Andrew Yang. But I'm going to be a ninja because one of my boys is going to be Shang-Chi. So I guess I'm going to be one of the ninjas he beats up. And then Evelyn is going to be Batgirl and our other son's going to be Batman. So it's a very, very big weekend in the Yang household. Evelyn's birthday, Christopher's birthday. We're going to be celebrating both independently. Believe it or not, they're both born on the same day, Halloween. So you can imagine it's like a triple whammy, super festive weekend ahead for us.
I'm not going to wear this.
That thing was horrifying. You guys should check out
that
video.
I feel bad that I wasted the money on it, but I thought it'd be funny to watch.
No, I mean, no, it's good that you, it's good that you didn't, man.
You,
I mean, I'm
but you have that, Halloween masks on Amazon for you.
I'm kind of pumped that it exists, but you know, if you decide to go as me, I think you should just
that mask.
Use the, you know, like, have your face be free to, you know.
I thought you would laugh. You know, it's actually hard to get you to laugh unless we're talking, making fun of something intellectually. You know what I'm saying?
I mean, I got to say, man, seeing like a horror movie version of your own face, like on your friend's face is like, I mean, if I busted out a Zach Grauman mask right now and it made you look like a serial killer.
I don't know if maybe I'd laugh. Someone in the Yang Gang went as me for Halloween, which is, I checked the life goal box, I think. I didn't know I had it, but it was a little, it's a different feeling. And I think the mask would have put me over the edge, I think. So anyway.
Happy Halloween, everyone.
Happy Halloween.
Independent media, support it. We're going to give you a lot more to support. Coming soon.
Happy Halloween from a terrifying, slightly offensive Andrew Yang mask.
And from the real one.
Love you guys. Later.